This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Like many of us, Amy Willits watched the TV coverage of the aftermath of the powerful earthquake that devastated much of Haiti in 2010. It destroyed buildings and infrastructure, killing residents and forcing hundreds of thousands to take refuge in tent camps. Unlike many of us, Amy Willits flew to Haiti after the earthquake, a country she had gotten to know as a journalist. Her award-winning book, The Rainy Season, was published in 1989. Her new book, Farewell Fred Voodoo, is about her fascination with and affection for Haiti and its resourceful and often misunderstood people. It's also about the aid organizations and aid workers in Haiti, some making a difference while others are padding their resumes. And she writes about Haiti's history and its complicated relationship with the United States. Amy Willits joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York City, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Thanks so much, Marty. I'm really happy to be with you
this morning. Happy to have you with us. And let's start with the title of your book, Farewell Fred Voodoo. Fred Voodoo is something that Haitians refer to, and I wonder if you could explain that to us.
Well, actually, it's not a Haitian saying. It is a. It's from the International Press Corps, and it was first. I was first introduced to Fred Voodoo by the British reporters who were covering the fall of Duvalier. And I would come back. I was a total newbie. I would come back from a day of hard reporting in the streets of Port-au-Prince, and the Brits would say to me, "Well, did you talk to Fred Voodoo today? What's Fred Voodoo saying?" And it was their way, their very politically incorrect way of saying, Joe Sixpack. And so I thought, with this book, what I wanted to do was dispel that character, Fred Voodoo, and the way people think about Haitians in general. And I wanted to give people a new window on who Haitians are, and not have them think of them in these retrograde, very old-fashioned ways that date back to the colony.
A very cliched ways, I guess, of thinking about Haitians.
Well, voodoo, with all it means to outsiders who don't know the real religion. So superstition, black magic, zombies, all stuff that, lurks in there a little bit but has been played up to an insane level by the outside media.
But as you say in this book and just said, you have done your share of interviews with Fred Voodoo.
I have. Fred Voodoo is my good friend. Fred Voodoo is my guide, But Fred Voodoo is everyone to these journalists. It's kind of a cipher representing the Haitian people. And for me, I wanted to turn that cipher into real individuals whom I know and who are named and have their names and their real identities.
And I do want to talk about all of that, but I'd love to have you read a section from your book on the bottom of page 38, where you're waiting for Jerry.
I'm reading, I just want everyone to know, from my Kindle, because I forgot to bring
you.
My book to the studio.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, so this happened to me. I was waiting outside one of the ad hoc earthquake camps that sprang up after the earthquake where displaced people were living. So that's where I am. I'm between an earthquake camp and a hotel where CNN puts up its studios when it was coming into the earthquake just after. So that's where this takes place. I'm waiting for Jerry and listening to the peripheral chatter directed at me. The streets around me are cleared of debris. In front of me is the Plaza Hotel, visibly untouched by the tremor. Behind me, life is carrying on in the camps. Things are weirdly normal. And then, coming at me like some kind of demented homeless vision of a zombie, is a man with dust-colored debris and pieces of cement adhering to his face and a ragged blue T-shirt wrapped around his head. He looks as if he's just walked out of the earthquake or just emerged from a burial ground. He seems disoriented and dangerous. I feel that I recognize him. And I do. I do. I remember. He is the man whose close-up portrait, taken by Shaw Schwartz, appeared in Time magazine a few days after the earthquake. In the photograph, the man's face is plastered with crackling cement and dust, and his head is wrapped in a blue T-shirt. The picture also appeared on the back cover of a photo book published by Time that was called Haiti, Tragedy and Hope. So I remember the man and his portrait. It's a pretty stunning photograph that seemed, at the time, to encapsulate the horror of the quake and also the endurance of Haitians. In the Schwartz photo, the guy is alert and almost smiling in spite of his dusty condition. Now, a year later, he's alert but not smiling. He's looking for business. And I notice right away that this apparition from history has singled me out as, for the moment, the only stupid white person available who might want to take his picture for money. With the unwitting help of Schwartz and time, he has turned himself into a living tourist attraction for the few tourists and many development workers and humanitarians who are visiting Haiti now. He is a fragment of the past more vivid than the statue of Toussaint Louverture, and he has joined the many Haitians and outsiders, too, who are capitalizing on the Haitian earthquake. He just happens to be the most literal embodiment of this phenomenon. He is rubble man. I can see this. I absorb all of this as he is coming toward me. I absorb the full absurdity and instrumental aspect of his getup. Even as I see him coming, I'm beginning to wonder about the original photo, and I start to go into what I call charity anxiety. But then my friends emerge from the camp and grab me, and I am taken away.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. And again, that's Amy Willens reading from her new book called Farewell, Fred Voodoo. And I guess this rubble man is a modern-day Fred Voodoo. I mean, there was his picture on Time magazine, and there he is looking the same but without that smile as you were in Haiti.
Right. He really is Fred Voodoo.
But he's kind of turned it into a business for himself.
He's turned wreck and ruin into a business. And I think that happened with the earthquake in many cases, both small cases like his and then much bigger cases like the reconstruction organizations.
You went back to Haiti after the earthquake and wrote about it, I have to say, in very provocative ways about your own relationship with this country. And it almost felt like, as you were describing it, like an affair that you just couldn't leave.
Well, I really didn't want to go back. I'd been trying very slowly and not very surely to kind of move away from Haiti and do other things. I have written other books in my life about other subjects, and I've written other articles about many other subjects, and I do some travel writing from time to time, but I wanted to write a novel, and indeed I had written about 100 pages of a novel, and then the earthquake happened, and I thought, Haiti. And I felt really, of course, very strongly about it, and I was very worried about a lot of my friends whom I couldn't contact in the first few days. And slowly but surely, I got sucked back in. I went down about 2 weeks late after the earthquake, so I consider that 2 weeks late. Uh-huh. I should have gone back the first day. And I didn't go back with the intention of writing a book in any way, shape, or form. I went back because I felt it was wrong to have spent so much time there and then to turn my back when something so disastrous had happened. But then when I'm in Haiti, I have so many ideas and I think so many thoughts and I notice so many things that I feel are important that after my second visit, I thought, okay, I'll do another book.
Well, and as you write about the numbers of people that flock to Haiti or even who are working in Haiti on reconstruction, you call in many ways them the crisis caravan, the disaster junkies, that there's something about this country that attracts a certain kind of person.
Well, of course, it attracts people from relief organizations. Right after the earthquake, that's normal. So people from international relief organizations go from tsunami to earthquake to tsunami to earthquake, and they come in. And they are, you know, many of them are very charming, very witty disaster junkies. They're like cowboys. They love to fix up places that are in the midst of catastrophe. And they're great and wonderful and really necessary. But after them, especially in Haiti, which was so devastated in its capital city and environs by this earthquake, after them come the reconstruction people. And that's a much more fraught and difficult task. Especially in a place like Haiti, which was already in the midst of disaster before the disaster struck.
When you say reconstruction people, when they come to a place like Haiti, what do they think their job is then?
They think they can fix it and remake it and put it together and kind of lift it from whatever era you might want to say Haiti's in, say the late 1800s, into the 21st century in 3 years by building it back better. That was Bill Clinton's slogan for Haiti.
Well, and what's shocking is that billions of dollars were either earmarked or perhaps in some of that has been actually spent in Haiti. And I wonder, I know you were there in December. Is there evidence that money has been well spent?
There's evidence that it had been spent on rubble removal. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rubble is gone, and there were, astrodomes full of rubble in the main city. I can't remember, like 19 astrodomes full of rubble spread out all over the city. You couldn't move, really. So heavy trucks came in to remove the rubble. So that's something that's good, and it's a cost. Right. And I think something like 5,900 temporary and permanent houses have been built to replace the housing of 1 million people. And this is after hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent. And I think housing was the most urgent project to be undertaken. And it has been undertaken in crazy, illegitimate ways that have not done much good for the Haitian people. It's a hard thing to do, to build a lot of houses very fast, but there should be more after 3 years.
In hindsight, and of course we're talking about 3 years after this earthquake, what would have been a better approach, and have Haitians been involved in their own reconstruction?
Well, those are two very different questions. I mean, yeah, they should have been involved in it. They haven't really been involved in it. One of my favorite stories is, and I don't think this is in the book, is how President Préval, who was president of Haiti during the earthquake, tried to find the international organizations in their tent at the airport who are having a meeting to decide where to distribute most of the funds that had been given out by international organizations. He wasn't invited to the meeting, and he couldn't find the tent they were in.
Wow. But does that say that, and this is broadly speaking, that outside organizations think that Haiti and Haitians either don't deserve a place at the table or wouldn't know what to do to rebuild their own country?
Marty, you're taking the words out of my own mouth.
Yes. Sorry, go ahead, Amy.
I think that's exactly what they're trying to say. It's gone beyond they don't think that they have anything to contribute and they don't trust them to the point where they don't even think of them. And this is interesting because lip service is always given to, you know, partnering with Haiti and partnering with Haitians and all these projects. But frankly, the way it was organized, I think there's an underlying fear of Haitians among outside organizations, not just mistrust, but like basic fear, so that all the people from this army of innocence, as I call the people who come in, or from the crisis caravan, they wall themselves off from the host population, and they don't really mingle with Haitians, and therefore they don't really know Haiti. They're kind of operating as a parallel government, condescending to this people and trying to invent what they think they might need.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Amy Willits, our guest today on Radio Times. She has a brand new book called Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. And she did go to Haiti a couple of weeks after that devastating earthquake of 3 years ago. She has been covering this country on and off for a number of decades now. Wrote the award-winning book, The Rainy Season, back in 1989. Joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York City, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY. Zollner Arts Center presents Mountain Heart this Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. for one show only. Mountain Heart combines bluegrass with rock, country, blues, and jazz, and brings their own style of excitement and energy to live performances. Tickets and more information are available at 610-7LU-ARTS or online at zollnerartscenter.org.
The days are slowly getting longer, meaning spring is fast approaching. Also approaching is the WHYY Winter Membership Campaign. You can help shorten the campaign by making your donation now. For every 750 donations we receive before January 30th, we'll cut one day off the campaign. That's less on-air fundraising and more news and information. Make your donation to support the WHYY buyback at whyy.org/support.
Through all the ups and downs of his dieting and weight loss, TV weatherman Al Roker kept a smile on his face even when the rude comments poured in. Well, later for that.
You know, I thought you were funnier when you were fatter. Yeah. I said, yeah, and I thought you were smarter before you opened your mouth.
Al Roker tells us about his new attitude in his new book. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and it has been about 3 years since Haiti was rocked by a earthquake. Amy Willits was there shortly after that earthquake hit, and as I said earlier, a country she knows very well. She's been there many, many times and has a new book called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. And we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. I'm really stuck on what you said right before the break about fear. Haitians. And I wonder whether that happens with other countries where organizations and individuals come in from the outside to fix or help assist when a country is hit by a disaster. Do you think there's something uniquely unique about Haiti when it comes to outside organizations?
Yeah, I think there's something unique about Haiti when it comes to outsiders, and it spills over into this kind of situation too. And that unique thing is the it seems so weird, but it's the fact of the Haitian Revolution, which was so long ago, started in 1791 and independence was gained in 1804, and it was a slave revolution. So French planters had sugar plantations and other plantations in Haiti, and the slaves rose up and defeated Napoleon Bonaparte. It was a shocking thing. It was a very premature separation from the colonial state. For instance, Jamaica didn't separate itself from Britain until 1965. Mm. So you can see how premature it was. And there was a feeling that it was a place of rogue Africans in the Americas. And I don't think you'd get the same kind of, say, fear of Italians when people go in to help after an earthquake in Italy, or fear of the Japanese when people go in to help in a situation of catastrophe in Japan. It's a racial problem, and it's a problem, it's a deep-seated psychological problem that Americans have with their own African-American population, and that's displaced onto the backs of the Haitians when we go in there.
Haiti is often described to an outsider like myself, seems just horrific conditions, whether it has to do with the environmental degradation, the level of corruption, the level of poverty, the level of unemployment. And again, as an outsider, it's just hard to imagine people living with and surviving all that difficulty of living.
Right. Everybody talks about Haitian resilience, you know.
Yes, I don't know what
and
that
life,
means. Yeah.
Life is very terrible there in certain ways. And also, you know, it's bearable. I mean, I don't like the impression people might have that, you know, people are crawling on their hands and knees around the streets, starving and thirsty. That's not true. But sometimes you do have to walk for 4 hours to get your drinking water for the next few days. It is a very difficult situation. And right now there's a cholera epidemic, just to add on to the fun and games down in Haiti. But the thing that I always try to keep in mind is what resilience really means. When it's used by outsiders, it often feels to me like it means no matter what we throw at them, they keep on going. You know, it's kind of a we're willing to take anything situation for Haitians. But what it really is, and I've examined it closely and thought about it a lot, is human resilience. It's not Haitian resilience, it's human resilience. And if you think about what humans in many different places have endured, we stand up and keep walking and keep having our lives. I mean, I think about my people during the Holocaust in Germany and Eastern Europe. Well, as long as we could, we kept on surviving. And that's the Haitian situation. They will keep on surviving. But I don't like it to be like, oh, these happy, smiling, antebellum slaves waiting for whatever crap the world throws at them.
You write an interesting thing, and this is part of Haiti's cultural history, but something that you describe as the habits of masquerade, the use of artifice and duplicity, your words, in describing perhaps how they deal with other people and deal perhaps with even some of their own political system, outsiders, and their own lives. It's a fascinating thing to think about.
Yeah, it's a really complicated bit of the book, but I can talk a little bit about it.
Okay.
Part of it stems from the master-slave relationship. So if you are completely at the mercy of someone and it is a systematized totalitarianism, which is what plantation slavery was, then you search as a human for any possible way to avoid being under the master's control. And duplicity and masquerade are ways to do that. And Haitians, in looking at people who seem to be more powerful than a Haitian himself, will always search for a way to keep a part of their motivation and their goal secret from that person. I mean, obviously, once you're on intimate terms, that's not the case anymore, and it's all humanity is the same. But there is that aspect of their behavior, and you can see it in conversation in Creole, that they have one pronoun for he, she, and it. And to me, that's wonderful, because the master couldn't know who you were referring to. So the slaves, even when the master could understand Creole, which eventually I'm sure they could, they couldn't really follow closely enough to know who he, she, or it is, you know? And so you could talk about someone and the master would never know.
But it's interesting that this has survived, even though, you know, slavery was, there was a slave revolt 150 years ago, but this masquerade still continues today.
Well, it continues today because Haiti has been treated by the rest of the world as a state apart in many ways, and for a long time after the revolution, certainly, for at least the U.S. didn't recognize Haiti's independence from France and its status as a republic until 1867, mm-hmm. which you will note is 2 years after the Civil War came to an end. So once our slaves were freed, then it was okay for Haitians to be free, sort of, but not really. And I think it stood as a reminder to us of slavery and the dreadfulness of what we inflicted on our own African Americans, and that plays into some kind of psychological problem. And then when Haitians look at the outside, they also see the face of the master in some respect or another, mm-hmm. even though it's such a long time ago. I mean, if you go into a Haitian village today as an outsider, and some big, tall, handsome guy comes up to you and starts telling you about the village and where you can get something to eat or where you could stay for the night, you think he's the guy in charge of the village. But actually, it's this little old lady sitting in a corner with her hat pulled down over her face, you know?
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Amy Willents, our guest today on Radio Times. Wrote a book about Haiti back in 1989, won a number of awards called The Rainy Season. Her new book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Amy, you write about a number of people who have been working in Haiti. Sean Penn, for one, Bill Clinton, of course, and also a woman from New Jersey, a woman named Dr. Megan Coffey. You write a lot about her, and the way you write about her, it sounds like you think she's doing good work in Haiti.
Well, she's a doctor, so let's first get that out of the way. It really helps to be a doctor. It's hard to do wrong things as a doctor in Haiti because there's so much need, and the fix can be pretty quick. You can give someone antibiotics, and they feel better, you know, within hours, and they have felt really bad for a really long time. So Megan is a infectious diseases specialist, and she came in after the earthquake, and she did mostly orthopedics and triage, which is what you do in a situation of crisis after an earthquake. But then, once that initial moment was over, she saw a need for a tuberculosis ward in the main hospital, and they hadn't had one, but she knew how to do it well. The main hospital hadn't had one in Port-au-Prince because they were afraid of the infectious nature of the disease. But Megan got a tent put up, and she started a ad hoc tuberculosis ward, which then has morphed by now into a permanent tuberculosis ward in the general hospital, and it's a real miracle. And she did it really completely seat of the pants with no funding from any large organizations. She eventually set up a little funding mechanism for her TB ward. But she really did the thing that you have to do to function properly in Haiti, which is you learn from Haitians how to deal with Haiti.
And what about Bill Clinton? How do you see his role and his relationship to Haiti?
Well, President Clinton really, really has an old affection for Haiti. And I think he really came to the job of Reconstruction with the best of motivations. But he's a gigantic machine, too. He almost, it's not, we're not really talking about the individual Bill Clinton. We're talking about the giant international machine that is Bill Clinton. And he came to symbolize also the successes, but mostly the failures of the Reconstruction push. And I think that, you know, he's been tarred with that, and I can't say unfairly, because he has so much prestige and so much ability to do good, and the good wasn't done. So I do hold him partly responsible for the failures, especially in the attempt to figure out how to house the Haitians who lost everything in the earthquake.
Mm. Sean Penn is someone else that you write about, and you interview as well for this book, and he did set up housing for Haitians, and looks sort of like yourself, having a complicated relationship with this country.
I would say about Sean Penn that he has a complicated relationship with everyone and everything.
Yourself
He's
included,
a complicated
right?
guy.
Yes,
myself
indeed.
Included.
I got
oh,
that
yeah.
feeling, yes.
We definitely have a very odd relationship, but it's a relationship nonetheless. And the thing about Sean Penn is that I like and admire, I can't help it, is he came down, okay, he's a movie star, that seemed really idiotic, what does he know? And he goes in, and then he stays. And again, like Megan Coffey, he lets Haiti teach him about how to deal with Haiti. He stayed in the camp for a long time. Now he stays in Haiti in some little room that I describe in my book. I mean, it's hilarious. It's like the room of a house servant where he stays. And he really has spent a lot of time in Haiti. Bill Clinton comes in and out. He doesn't really sit around, you know, lie around in the camps with Haitians at all. He comes in, he goes out, and he deals with mostly the elite and political figures. But Sean Penn has really been around the block in Haiti. And he's done a lot of dumb things, especially at the beginning, but he does a lot of smart things. One of the things he's doing is building back the neighborhoods where the Haitians came from, bolting their houses, and really setting up housing that they want to move back to, as opposed to kind of cinder block townships on the outskirts of town where they don't want to live, but many have been forced to live. He also took down the presidential palace, the ruins of the presidential palace, with other groups and with a Haitian team too. But that was really important to do because it was an ugly remembrance of the earthquake.
You say some interesting things about yourself and obviously your relationship with Haiti, but you acknowledge the fact that you've made, and I'm semi-quoting here, an eighth of your income from writing about Haiti.
Yeah. Well, what really began to disturb me as I was writing the book and thinking, oh, my God, this thing is going to be published, is that I was, you know, if it hadn't been for an earthquake that killed 300,000 people approximately, I wouldn't be writing the book, and I wouldn't have gotten the contract, and I wouldn't have gotten an advance, and I wouldn't be making money. So you feel conflicted, and everybody who works in Haiti should feel this conflict really seriously. You feel conflicted making money or taking any gain from so much pain and agony. And I try to give back both through my writing. I mean, I hate the expression give back because people use it so flippantly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've really taken from Haiti. So I really try to give back both by through my writing and through other little kind of mini reconstruction projects I do.
Are profits from your book going to an organization?
No, I don't do that.
You
don't believe in that? No, don't do that. But I gave one my book party. I happened to have to give my book party in L.A. on the actual anniversary of the Haitian earthquake, and I just felt, like, loathsome about it. So I fundraised for Partners in Health at that party so that I could, you know, assuage a little bit of my guilt in giving a party on that day.
And that's Paul Farmer and his organization that's been in Haiti for a while. And doing good work?
I think they do great work. They now have built a giant teaching hospital in the countryside, which is a great idea, but they have to get it funded and running. And it's going to be a wonderful institution, I hope, but it's hard to get the human capacity into it.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Dan from the Northeast, or Dan from Windmore, I guess. Dan, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Let's see, I have written an article for a website for medical professionals called Medscape, dealing with the aftermath of the earthquake, and specifically with some ophthalmologists who had been going down there before and since the earthquake. one thing that one of my sources identified was bad roads make it, and infrastructure make it very hard to develop anything outside of the major cities. A second thing was they're bringing in donated equipment, according to her, and it's sitting at the port waiting for them to pay a tariff on donated equipment. And third, they're training local ophthalmologists, but understandably, because of their economic situation, they're selling to some of their private patients donated goods, medicines. How do you change the culture? How do you change the government? I mean, these are bureaucratic and cultural barriers that existed before the earthquake and are not helping since the earthquake.
Dane, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Amy, go ahead.
Well, I think that we need, obviously, a complete rethinking of Haiti. I mean, the minute you go from the littlest thing, trying to fix the littlest thing, you see that you need a huge change in the country. And, you know, Haiti did try to have that huge change with President Aristide, but there were two coups against him. Each time he took power, he was overthrown. I'm not saying he was the perfect answer, but it was an attempt by Haitians to change the system a little bit. And that system would include the kind of corruption you're describing at customs. You know, customs, quite rightly, Haitian customs says, look, we're not going to just let things through because we had an earthquake. We need to go through the proper paperwork, et cetera. But there is baroque habits of corruption in customs that still continued during the time of the earthquake. So that is absolutely true. The problem with selling donated goods is a problem in every country that receives humanitarian relief. Haiti is not alone in that. There are lots and lots of bad problems. The infrastructure problem, which you referred to at the beginning, has been somewhat alleviated. Of course, the rubble has been taken out of the streets, but also new roads have been built by Haitians with help from the outside, and they still need to do more work on that. One thing I hate about the new roads, though, is that it opens up all of Haiti to penetration, and it wrecks the old ways of Haiti. But that's probably just my own outsider's desire for Haiti to remain as a souvenir for me.
Oh, interesting. A souvenir for you because of all the years that you have spent there?
That's right. I want it to be like the 1980s, which was like the 1880s. And it's changing. And roads make it change faster. But Haitians need those roads.
Well, let's take a very short break. And I do want to talk about Haiti in the 1980s, something that you wrote about in a previous book. But let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, Amy Willits, our guest today on Radio Times. She's a journalist and author. And again, that book that she wrote back in 1989, The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, won a number of awards. And her new book, which we have been talking about, is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo. And she was most recently in Haiti in December, went to that country, back to that country after the earthquake of 3 years ago. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Violette Damasia Foundation supports WHYY. Are you an art lover? Do you know what makes something a work of art? The Violette Damasia Foundation is now enrolling for their spring art appreciation classes, talks, and tours at locations including the Philadelphia Academy of the Fine Arts, the Chester County Historical Society, and the Barnes Foundation. Registration is online at www.demazia.org.
The abuse and murder of civilians was far more common in the Vietnam War than most Americans imagined, according to a new book by Nick Terse. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Terse about his book, Kill Anything That Moves. It's based on extensive research in military archives and interviews with both military veterans and Vietnamese civilians. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Why? Why do people make decisions they regret 10 years down the road? Like getting that tattoo or rushing to marry that certain someone? New research says many of us underestimate how much will change in the future. We pretty much believe who we are now is who we'll be tomorrow. And we think this knowing that we have changed a lot in the past. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, what research tells us about our future selves. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Amy Willits, our guest, we're talking about her new book, Farewell, Fred Voodoo. The book examines early slave plantation days in Haiti, the political dynasties, various guerrilla movements, a slave rebellion, the troubled relationship with the United States. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Amy, let me get to Brian from the North to join us on Radio Times. And Brian, go ahead. You are on the air.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
Good morning. I appreciate this topic. Haiti is near and dear to my heart. I've been traveling there since 2007, about 20 times. And the question you undoubtedly get, I want to ask Amy about this, is what do you do when you go to Haiti? What do you do? Everybody asks you that at the airport. What do you do?
Yeah.
And my initial trip, I was in Miami Airport, and the woman was asking me, what am I going to do? I didn't really know how to answer it. And I asked, well, what are you doing? And she said, well, I'm going down to convert the heathens. And what I realized in the airports when I go a lot is 95% of the travelers are Christian mission teams. And I'm a practicing Christian. I love Christianity, whatever. But what I find with the Christian teams is it's almost like a colonization now. It's like fertile ground for these groups to go in. And I know it's a delicate topic, but I want to hear Amy's comments, what she feels about the massive numbers of Christians that kind of descend on this country. And I view it as almost like a colonization. Not that they're not doing good, I think, but in general, what I see is like you have the Bible in one hand and your aid package in the other, whatever that aid entails. Well, I'd just like to get her comments on that.
Yeah, me too, Brian. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Amy Willings, go ahead.
Well, Brian, I'm much harsher than you are. Yeah, I think it's an occupation. And it's not just the missionaries, of course, but the missionaries are and have been a particular bête noire of mine, to use a fraught expression. But, you know, they come in and they've got their Bible in one hand. That one of them I was examining for my book, I looked it up, and it was for younger people, and it said, have an awesome adventure in Haiti. This is after the earthquake. I just couldn't believe it.
Wow.
You know, awesome adventure. It sounded like spring break or something. So they come down, and they what they're trying to do is eradicate voodoo. So that's why they say that they're converting the heathens. And then they offer money in exchange for souls. It's very old fashioned.
And do Haitians buy it, so to speak?
Well, some Haitians buy in completely. Like, you like a god who gives you money and food. That's kind of nice. But many of them like the food and money, and they don't pay much attention to the god part, which I think is the practical way to deal with these people.
Brian, thanks for the call to Radio
Thank
Times.
You.
Let me go back to the 1980s and your book, The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. Interestingly, the son, Jean-Claude, is back in Haiti after essentially being, I don't know, sure, forced out is exactly the right word or not, but leaving
yes.
the country under you know, this cloud of corruption and ineptitude.
And human rights abuses.
And violence, yes.
And violence, and having a secret police that bashed down people's doors and took them away and incarcerated them without rights to an attorney for months and months and months, some of them my friends. Yeah, he's back. So to me, when he came back, it felt like, well, we might as well erase the book I wrote, because the book I wrote was called The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier,
yes.
which is a little ambiguous, but it meant since Duvalier left. But now he's back, and he's doing whatever the heck he likes. And the new president, you know, invites him to official engagements and hugs him at New Year's. And it's just astonishing to me. We might as well have skipped 25 years of history.
And he is embraced or has not been arrested because he's still a powerful figure in Haiti?
Well, he's not a powerful figure, but he means something.
Mm.
And he means kind of now he's been sort of watered down, and symbolically, I think he means to a return to steadiness and stability and law and order that people knew before he fell. Now, you know, if you stayed out of the way and you didn't mind having no freedom of speech, no freedom of thought, no freedom of dissent, and no democracy, so if you just stayed out of the way and kept your head down under Baby Doc, you could probably survive, although you'd probably end up paying exorbitant taxes, protection money to the Tontamakut in your neighborhood. But life was pretty normal, and Haiti was still feeding itself pretty much. But now, with globalization and the fall of Duvalier, democracy hasn't exactly implanted itself in a very institutionalized way. And also the country is in the throes of economic chaos because of globalization.
And where does the Tontamakut still exist?
Well, the men themselves, many of them are still around, but they're no longer organized into a secret police brigade. Mm.
And how is Aristide viewed?
He's also back, by the way. He was overthrown in 2004, and he came back the same year as Duvalier, within 2 months of each other, I believe, or three.
That's pretty wild.
He's still there. I think he's symbolically, he's very important, too. He symbolizes democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, which we have now in Haiti. There's freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to dissent, but there isn't an institutional feel for democracy that really makes it work. The judiciary is still in a shambles. I mean, it makes it very easy for criminal elements and corrupt business to be done in Haiti, so maybe there's an institutional reason to have a lack of institutions, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But Aristide is still there, and he's not very visible or valuable for a man who used to be very visible and very valuable.
So what do you see as the future of Haiti, even looking ahead, let's say, 5 to 10 years?
Well, I'll give you my hopeful
instead
of my pessimistic, which is really my nature. I'm hoping that in the next round of elections, Haitians will elect someone who is a serious Democrat who believes in Haiti and who is not tainted by being selected by outsiders, but as an actual real Haitian choice. I'm hoping that the legislature in Haiti will get its act together so that it functions as a respectable institution. I think this is entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that Haiti will be able to have its own economy while being inside the global economy. I don't think you can really escape from the global economy, especially if you're as poor as Haiti is. So they're in it whether they like it or not, but I think they can figure out new sources of revenues and ways to exist in the digitalized world that might be innovative and special and perhaps lead the third world as they used to do in the old days.
So that's your optimistic, hopeful
that's
view
optimistic.
Of Haiti. What do you worry about?
Oh, that another right-wing, uncaring president. Not that this guy doesn't care. Michel Martelly is the president. But someone incompetent, again, will be chosen. He's a musician. He can be led any which way.
Mm.
I'm hoping that it'll be someone of principle who's elected. But my worry is that it will not, and that outsiders like Haitians to elect incompetence so that they can continue to kind of exploit the country. My fear is that gold mines will be opened that will be hugely environmentally dangerous and disastrous, but will not really bring any money into Haiti into the government's coffers.
You said outsiders like Haitians to elect incompetence.
Yes.
Continuing this, you did say that. continuing this what relationship that outsiders have with this country.
If you have an incompetent running a country and you have an incompetent legislature, and you're a person who likes to do nefarious business and import export and not pay tariffs and just hand out a bribe here and there, it's much more efficient and less costly than complying with forms and letting people know what you're doing. If you're a drug dealer using Haiti as a transshipment place, that makes life a lot easier if everybody around you who would otherwise impose law on you is an incompetent and you can just pay them off. So, if you see what I mean, incompetence seems to be an institutional method in Haiti so that it's porous mm-hmm. and can be used for whatever purpose.
What do you make, or what did you make of Wyclef Jean and his bid for the presidency?
My favorite story about Wyclef is when he went to the presidential palace before he was running, and he comes in all dressed up in his nice outfit, and he really is a very handsome and imposing man. And he comes into the presidential office looking for President Préval. And some people talk to him, and he sits down, and then he stands up, and he's standing, towering over this little guy who's wearing a guayabera and pressed trousers and sandals. And finally, Wyclef gets so irritated. He says, you know, I am here to speak to President Préval. And the little guy looks up at him, and he says, well, I am President Préval.
And he did not know it.
He hadn't even bothered to Google image President Préval, who's actually pretty special looking because he has a full beard, unlike most Haitians.
Your book is about many things about Haiti, including the U.S. relationship with Haiti. I think many people might not know that between, I think, 1915 to 1934, Haiti was essentially under U.S. military occupation.
That's right. It was one of our first experiments with total occupation of a country, and it was a pretty harsh time. It had some good consequences for Haitians. There were much better roads. The U.S. Marines helped build the presidential palace that eventually fell down in the earthquake, a very beautiful building. But it was a very racist regime, the U.S. occupation. And as usual with Haiti, they're first at everything. There was a freedom-fighting liberation movement, the first Third World freedom-fighting liberation movement in Haiti. And it was successful. And in 1934, the Americans were forced to leave.
Let me get Frank from Medford to join our conversation. And Frank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Amy, I read your book, the first one. I have to tell you, I don't see how you can paint missionaries all with the same brush, like you said about 10 minutes ago. My organization has 5 medical clinics in the country. We've been going since 1989. We have a staff of 22 Haitians we employ. None of us up here in the States take any salary. We take medical teams in, and they do stuff per gratis. We get stuff donated from all over the world to send down. We're doing good stuff, and we're Christians, and take it easy on us, all right?
And Frank, hold on one second. Well, what's the name of your organization, Frank?
Hope Alive Clinic.
Frank, can I respond?
Yeah, go ahead, Amy.
Frank, I love Christians. I'm almost a Christian. I'm the most Christian Jew you'll ever meet because I love Christians so much.
Well,
I love the liberation. I love the Liberation Church, the Catholic Church, that side of it. And I think missionaries do great work in Haiti, some of them. My only problem with them is, why are they missionaries? Why don't they just go on a mission and not try to convert people? Stop trying to convert Haitians. Let Haitians have their own religion. Let them behave as they want to behave and help them out. I love that you're doing all those clinics. That's fantastic. But, you know,
absolutely.
I just...
Most of the missionaries that we work with and we bring down, we just introduce people to Christ. We let them make the decision. We don't hold a Bible in one hand and food in the other. We don't force anything on them. It's just to introduce people to Christ and let them make a decision.
Okay. And well, I will respond to that.
We take food to people and everything.
Oh, hold on, Frank. Go ahead, Amy.
You just introduce them to Christ, but if you introduce them to Christ at your clinic where you're curing their, you know, bacterial infection, it is a little bit like, you know, saying, here's Christ and here's some food. What do you think? And you know, it's a bribe, no matter how you slice it. And Christ is a very compelling figure. You know, introduced to Christ, I'm sure many, many people would move over to Christ, but not everyone. And I don't think that's all you're doing.
Go ahead, Frank. You know?
No, it's just an introduction. No one's getting hit over the head. And we've got people that have come back years and years, and they're not Christians. We're doing the work that God has told us to do. We're bringing
a cup of
cold water to the desert.
Frank,
I think that's
great. If you take all the Christians out of Haiti, boy, it's going to be a real bad thing.
Well, Frank, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Do you agree with
that,
Amy?
I think it's an interesting point of view. If you take all the people who have more money out of Haiti... then Haitians are going to have a bad time. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's not true, though. There's the possibility that if you just took those people out of Haiti, Haitians might figure out how to do things by themselves. Mm. If we only would teach and not bring in, I don't know. I'm very conflicted about this whole issue of what is helping Haiti and what is harming Haiti. And I'm often worried, because I see so many examples of it, that helping hurts in the end.
Frank, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Amy, we're almost out of time here, but I just want to quote something that you wrote in your book. My rule is, don't be full of pity and charity. Don't feel sorry for them. Rule number one, be glad you're not in their situation, but don't pity. Their pain is theirs, and in disasters and destroyed places, their pain and their survival are sometimes even important aspects of their identity. This is part of your struggle, knowing people and caring about people who are living in dire situations.
That's right. And I just don't want them to be objects. I don't want them to be objectified. I don't want them to just be victims. And I don't want to feel sorry all the time. I've seen Haitians happier than me sometimes who are in the worst conditions. So they're not always desperate for that glass of water.
So have you said farewell to Haiti?
No, never. Never, 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 never. Just to Fred Voodoo, but
just,
not to Haiti.
Just to Fred Voodoo. In terms of the press coverage, we almost don't have time for this, but you write about Anderson Cooper and others that went down during the height of the earthquake and its aftermath. Any final thoughts about that kind of coverage?
Yeah, you know, it's Fred Voodoo coverage. Aren't they beautiful in the morning light when they're going to find water and there's a fire in their tent and, you know, the whole country is falling apart around them? Don't they look like African statues? You know, it's all this kind of objectification of the victim that is so beautiful for television, and Haitians are so good at looking great in disasters. And I hate it.
Well, Amy Willens, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. The book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can learn much more about this program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Heather Brumfield, our intern for today's edition of the show. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.